Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. Will Ukraine become Russia's forever war? And if so, what does that mean for the rest of the world? Let's get to the bottom line. It's been 2 weeks since Russia started a new chapter in our history book, shaking up the world order by invading Ukraine. Now folks around the world are asking the same questions. Is this how World War III starts? Could this war go nuclear? What's the end game in the mind of Russian President Vladimir Putin? Is there any way out that actually brings some sense of stability to the region? And besides sanctioning Russia and arming Ukraine, what will the response of the West be? And though some detest this question when passions are really running high, how did we get here? Those are the issues at stake, and we're fortunate today to be talking with one of the world's foremost experts on Russia and global strategic competition. Anatole Levin, a senior research fellow on Russia and Europe at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and author of Ukraine and Russia, A Fraternal Rivalry. I guess I should say not so fraternal anymore. Anatole, it's a real pleasure to be with you today, and let's just take it where we are today. You're one of the world's leading realists. What is Vladimir Putin's objective at this moment? Where do you see things going?
To find out what Putin is thinking, ask Putin. I don't live inside his brain. What I can say is that if the intention was to replace the Ukrainian government with a pro-Russian government, then, you know, unless Putin has truly gone crazy, the Russians must realize that that simply will not work because of the strength and unity of the Ukrainian resistance. I mean, any government put in by Russia would, you know, lack all legitimacy and could only be kept in place by a permanent Russian army and permanent repression. Indeed, I think that's also true of Russian-speaking areas in the east and south of Ukraine. The only chance for Russia, the only chance to take over those areas and use them as a base within Ukraine, politically speaking, was if Russia could do that quickly and relatively painlessly. Well, now it's going to rule over a heap of ruins and innumerable civilian deaths. It really is not easy to see how, you know, Russia can win its political goals within Ukraine.
Is this now not a conflict between major powers, including us? What are your views?
Well, yes, it is becoming a proxy war, you know, as so many tragic conflicts during the Cold War. One should not forget, though, that there are voices in America, including, after all, the former U.S. commander of NATO, General Breedlove, who are calling for a no-fly zone. Well, that means sending the U.S. Air Force in as allies of the Ukrainians to fight against Russia. I mean, then we are coming very close indeed to a war between the world's two greatest nuclear powers. But even a proxy war will have dire implications for European and global security. And of course, it will also mean the long-running deep economic sanctions, which we can already see the effects both on global energy prices, but also, I mean, and this is what really worries me, global food prices, because Russia is the biggest global food exporter and Ukraine is also a major food exporter. Now, we know from the run-up to the Arab Spring and other cases, the ability of inflation of food prices to cause deep instability around the world, including in key US allies. So Russia, of course, has a colossal amount to lose and has begun to lose it as a result of this war. But we shouldn't ignore the fact that the West and the rest of the world has a lot to lose as well.
Well, Anatole, around the time when you and I first got to know each other, which was in the late 1990s, you wrote a book on Ukraine and Russia, which we just mentioned. And in there, you write very clearly, this is more than 20 years ago, any attempt by one side or the other, by Russia or the West, to take Ukraine fully into an alliance with either of them would disastrously split Ukraine. Let me also read this statement from former U.S. ambassador to Russia, and now the current CIA director, William Burns. And this was, folks, this is in the WikiLeaks document. This was a classified cable from then Ambassador Burns on the 1st of February, 2008. Burns writes, NATO enlargement, particularly to Ukraine, remains an emotional and neuralgic issue for Russia. These include fears that the issue could potentially split the country in two, leading to violence or even some claim civil war, which would force Russia to decide whether to intervene. So we can look back at this time, and it's one of these uncomfortable discussions that perhaps to come later, when we're seeing civilians killed in this conflict, we're seeing really a horrible kind of kinetic war. This is not the sort of hybrid cyber war that I thought Russia was investing in. This is old-style nastiness. But it does raise the question of what our blind spots are as we look at America's strategic equities in the world and what we're willing to pay for our principles. What is the price of those principles? And I guess if you were advising President Biden or NATO at this moment, what would be some of the guidelines you would put in place, Anatole?
Well, I think one of the things I tell them is that the idea of a treaty of neutrality, which is now being demanded by Russia, but which has been proposed by many of us for many years now, it's talked about in the West as if this is simply a concession on the Ukrainian side or on our side. It isn't. A treaty of neutrality, as signed by Finland and Austria in different ways during the Cold War, excluded them from joining NATO, but it also excluded them from joining the Warsaw Pact. A treaty of neutrality for Ukraine would rule out Ukraine joining NATO. It would also rule out Ukraine joining the Eurasian Union and any other Russian-led alliance. So, you know, what we need to focus on is maintaining the sovereignty of Ukraine. Of course, I mean, Russian domination of Ukraine, as I suggested, you know, the appointment of a pro-Russian government is impossible now and must, of course, be absolutely rejected. But it still seems to me that we can learn from the Cold War and the examples of Finland and Austria that a treaty of neutrality is, in fact, a perfectly good way out of this horrible war and out of this trap. Because the other thing you have to remember about Finland and Austria, I visited those countries during the Cold War. You couldn't tell they weren't part of the West. They couldn't be part of NATO, but they were completely functioning Western free market democracies. I cannot understand why this aspect of things is not talked about more widely in the West, and why we could not negotiate a treaty of neutrality before this war.
What is your sense? You know more people in Russia than anyone else I know. Are you able to talk with them, converse? What's the sense of stress? And does that create a cost for Putin?
In the long run, I think yes. I mean, at the moment, you know, ordinary Russians, quite frankly, have been to a great degree brainwashed by state propaganda in Russia. But as you say, as the body bags come back, as the economic costs rise and living standards decline, I think that unrest against Putin is bound to grow. Now, you can already see deep unease in sections of the Russian elites. Two interesting categories here. One is some of the biggest businessmen have, and people, by the way, who've been very close to Putin, very supportive of Putin, have publicly called for an end to the war and warned of its economic consequences. The other interesting thing is that some of the children of the Russian elites, you know, who've been educated in the West, have Western lifestyles, many Western friends, they have started to come out against the war. And in both these cases, it's because these people understand much, much better than the mass of the population just how much Russia is going to suffer from this. So I think over time, it will be, yes, I mean, it will really undermine Putin's rule. But the problem is that the decision-making circle around Putin and the people he listens to has narrowed so far, particularly since COVID began, that it now consists of barely half a dozen people. We talk about the Russian elites in general. We talk about Russian oligarchs. Calling them oligarchs is actually wrong. These big Russian businessmen have no political power anymore. They don't play a part in deciding on issues of war and peace. And so while I think it very likely in the long run that Putin, you know, will be removed, it will be, I fear, a long and difficult process because it will mean getting rid not just of him, but of his inner circle as well. Now, one can imagine deals whereby this is done, you know, guaranteeing their personal safety, guaranteeing their family's property. But they're, you know, they're a tough and resolute bunch. I think they will, absent a peace settlement, and a peace settlement that can create some appearance of success for Russia and for them. I think they're prepared to fight on for a long time.
But I was surprised, Anatole, about Putin's hastiness in waving his nuclear arsenal around. I was very surprised because it seemed to indicate to me a concern about the capabilities of his conventional forces. What are your take on that, and what do you sense in your knowledge of, you know, mutual assured destruction and, you know, nuclear conflict is going on there? And what are your thoughts about the Russian military after seeing it for nearly 2 weeks?
Well, it's clear that things are not going nearly as well as Putin and the Russian government hoped. And I think here the key point is that the Ukrainians have done what the Chechens did. In 1995 and in 1999, they have retreated, if you like, into the Ukrainian cities, and they are prepared to fight it out street by street. And, of course, this is disastrous for Russia's political goals because it will lead to the destruction of those cities. But urban warfare, of course, does also act, as America has found sometimes, partly to negate, you know, superiority in weapons and firepower. Now, as to Putin waving the nuclear weapon, I think, you know, it's perfectly obvious he's trying to scare the West and the Europeans in particular into limiting their support for Ukraine. I do not think that he intends to use this weapon. But, of course, the risks are, you know, if the United States introduced a no-fly zone with American aircraft operating out of bases in Poland, then I have very little doubt that Russia would attack those bases with missiles. Then we would get into something which, you know, throughout the Cold War, leaders on both sides were so careful to avoid, which is an actual direct military clash between the two nuclear superpowers of the world. But, of course, even a long-running guerrilla war supported from the West, supplied across Poland, would give Russia, you know, such an incentive to disrupt Europe and the West in every way possible. What I also fear there is that an insurgency in Ukraine, because, you know, I traveled with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s, and I've studied the history of insurgencies, there is an almost automatic tendency in these circumstances for the most extreme and hard-line sections of the insurgents to come to the fore. In this case, this is extreme Ukrainian ethnic nationalists. Now, it seems to me that the only thing that could drive the Russian-speaking population of eastern and southern Ukraine back into the arms of a Russia, which frankly by now they detest, would be if they came under threat from extreme Ukrainian nationalists who hate not just Russia as a state, but also Russians, including Ukrainian Russians as a people. So I think this is something that we have to be very, very careful about.
Well, I want to go back to something you just said, which is very interesting, because I talked to some senior Polish government officials recently who said it is inevitable that Poland will become as Pakistan was to Afghanistan. We will drive, supply, and help direct an insurgency. And in that in Ukraine, and in that case, wouldn't Russia then, as you just said, I think, step in to try to do something against Poland, which is a NATO member?
Yes. I mean, that is precisely it. NATO then comes very close to conflict with Russia. I mean, that is why I and others are so strongly advocating an attempt, however difficult, to bring about an early peace settlement to this conflict.
Well, the other question I have is, you know, we're going to look back at this moment, and I'm wondering if someone's going to stand up. You and I both know Zbigniew Brzezinski, the late Zbigniew Brzezinski, who sort of took credit for the Soviet invasion in Afghanistan, saying he helped lead them into Afghanistan and into their own Vietnam. The question, there's a RAND study that was published a few years ago that basically said perhaps the smart strategy was to find ways to impose costs on Russia. And this study said that if you could unbalance, that you could do cost-imposing options that could unbalance and overextend Russia, such cost-imposing options could place new burdens on Russia, ideally heavier burdens than would be imposed in the U.S. for imposing these options. Now, I don't believe that the study actually endorsed taking this step in Ukraine, but it's going to raise a question at some level on whether Russia is now the one that's stuck in its quagmire, that it's a good distraction to have Russian power and attention focused in something like this. Is there any sense to that logic at all?
Well, I don't think so, because in the Cold War, the Soviet Union was aligned against the United States on so many different fronts, challenging American interests in Africa, in the Middle East, in Central America. Today, at least in the greater Middle East, including Afghanistan, objectively speaking, on the key issue, Russia is on America's side against ISIS, against Sunni Islamist extremism. You know, Russia is not aligned against, oh, and by the way, in Western Africa as well. One may dislike greatly the history and nature of the Wagner private security group, but the fact is that in Western Africa, they're fighting against the same people that we are, Islamist insurgents. So this isn't like the Cold War at all in that way. This, you know, Ukraine is not a distraction from somewhere else. Ukraine is about Ukraine. I mean, the other thing that I really do think, amidst all this moralizing language, that we should remember is that these proxy wars during the Cold War in Afghanistan, in Angola, in Central America were waged over the corpses in Indochina, obviously, but were waged over the corpses of innumerable local people who died and suffered in these conflicts. And of course, then there is the irony of history. As I say, I was with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Less than 20 years after the Soviets withdrew and the communist government in Afghanistan fell, America was trying to recruit former communist officers in Afghanistan to fight in the Afghan National Army against the Taliban, who were the lineal descendants of the Mujahideen who we had supported. So, you know, please, let's think, you know, about what's going to happen to Ukraine in the process and not turn this into some new version of the Cold War.
Anatole, you more than almost anyone I know have a foot, several feet in different continents around the world, but you know America well. We worked together years ago at the New America Foundation, and I know you know this country. Right now, you have some Republican leaders in the United States Senate. You have a former U.S. president that keep lauding Vladimir Putin as a savvy genius. You have real ambivalence through a lot of the American public about Ukraine and what it represents at all to American interests, not looking at the broader NATO parts of this. But there is a kind of trend inside the United States, folks, where whether you call it America first, but a sort of tendency to disregard the benefits that come from the kind of American engagement in the world. And I'd be interested in what you think about American public opinion going a different direction than we've just articulated with what's happening with military resolve in NATO.
Well, I think anyone who expresses admiration anymore for Putin's intelligence is crazy, frankly. I used to admire him as a savvy operator, but clearly, I mean, what he's done in Ukraine proves recklessness, foolishness, extreme ambition, and an incapacity, it would seem now, to listen to intelligent advice. So, I really think anyone who's still talking about Putin as a strategic genius has not been reading the news or looking at the pictures. But as far as Americans who doubt the wisdom of America becoming engaged in really heavy commitments and real economic sacrifices for ordinary Americans as part of a struggle against Russia in Ukraine, I think that is, you know, a very strong segment of opinion, which I think is likely to grow. If Russia's intentions are to subjugate and rule the whole of Ukraine, then I think you will see real, you know, solidarity, not just within America, but between America and Europe. Over this. But if it becomes a question of waging an unending proxy war, basically in order to give up, to hold on to a principle of NATO membership for Ukraine, which nobody believes can happen anyway, since NATO will not fight for Ukraine, and to insist on Russian withdrawal from Crimea, which will never happen. Every Russian, the most liberal Russians I've talked to, say that that is impossible. Well, then I think you might well see, you know, a backlash against this in Western opinion. So, I mean, my feeling is I totally support the harshest economic sanctions against Russia, but they must be tied to the aim of bringing about an early end to this war, not just for the sake of the Ukrainians, but also because I think that over time this might also lead to a serious fraying of the Western alliance.
Let me also ask you, Anatole, about the recent peace efforts. So there's been one set of peace efforts between representatives of Zelensky's government and Russia meeting in Belarus, but there's also been this interesting Israeli track that we've just learned about. Be interested to know what you think about these two tracks, particularly the Israeli one, whether you think there's any prospect of achieving what you've suggested, which is an early peace and a new equilibrium in all of this.
Well, I would be delighted if the Israelis would broker a peace process. The Russian and Ukrainian foreign ministers have agreed to meet in Turkey later this week, which is also, of course, neutral territory between the two. It seems to me that if Russia's principles for peace are sincere, and Russia is not still determined to impose a pro-Russian government on Ukraine, then in principle, these ought to be negotiable. As I say, a treaty of neutrality, Zelensky has hinted at that, and in any case, it makes logical sense. Recognition of Russian sovereignty over Crimea. Russia is not going to abandon Crimea, perhaps, as Thomas Graham, former US diplomat in Moscow, and others have suggested, there would be a way of legitimizing this internationally by a referendum under international supervision. The Russian foreign minister, Lavrov, has suggested that demilitarization, which is a Russian demand, might only mean Ukraine giving up long-range missiles aimed at Russia. In other words, this would really be very close to the deal that ended the deals that ended the Cuba missile crisis. In other words, not Ukraine giving up its own armed forces, that's out of the question, of course, but a limitation on certain kinds of weapons. And on denazification, well, that is very difficult, but we're not sure exactly what it means. In my view, what the Ukrainians should do, particularly, after all, because Russian speakers and Russians in Ukraine have demonstrated their loyalty to Ukraine in this war and deserve some credit and reward for that. What Ukraine should do is give up its legislation, which is attempting to drive the Russian language out of public life in Ukraine, and guarantee the status of Russian as a minority language under the Russian constitution, under the Ukrainian constitution. Now, I don't know, of course, if any of this would work. But if there is a desire for peace on both sides, and if this process receives the full backing of the West, as it should, then I do think that there should be a possibility of an agreement along these lines.
Well, without deluding ourselves, I'm still pleased that we can end on a somewhat of a fortunate, positive possibility, if not likelihood, given everything that's going on. Anatole Lieven from the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
So what's the bottom line? The West can't pretend it's not in direct conflict with Russia anymore. The yachts of Russia's billionaires are being impounded, and huge corporations are pulling their investments. Airspace is being blocked, and America is supplying Ukraine with weapons. So it's already a conflict between the great powers, and there's no going back. A lot of people, unfortunately, are going to die while Russia and the West decide the next moves. In this new Cold War, the world is more connected, but it's a network of fear rather than of trust. Everyone loses when fear and anxiety torpedo the global trust and sense of common purpose needed to tackle our global challenges. And that's the bottom line.